As Unitarian Universalists, we find wisdom and inspiration in many places, Jewish and Christian scriptures and other sacred texts, the arts, science, nature, and our own experiences. Our tradition keeps us open to revelation from many sources. Today's wisdom comes from one of our own. John Haynes Holmes was probably the best known Unitarian preacher in America in the earliest 20th century. He was also a social activist, being a co-founder of both the ACLU and the NAACP. His written works were broadly published, and the following observation about the moral dimension of status of workers is taken from his book, The Revolutionary Function of the Modern Church, published in 1912. Poverty in this age, as in every age, in our country, as in every country, is primarily due to the fact of social injustice. That employment cannot be had by those who are ready to work. That employment, even when regular, is not paid enough to enable the faithful and efficient workman to guard against illness, to protect his widow from dependence, or to provide for his own old age. That insufficient wages force thousands of families to crowd into unhealthy tenements, to eat insufficient food, and to wear insufficient clothing, thus paving the way for physical weakness and disability. That accident robs the wage earners without compensation from society. That taxes are inequitable, throwing the chief burden upon the poor instead of upon the rich. That natural resources, which are the basis of all wealth, are in the hands of a few instead of under the control of society at large, and thus are exploited for the benefit of the few and not for the sake of the common welfare. That the distribution of wealth is grossly unfair and disproportionate. In the final analysis, that society is organized upon a basis of injustice and not of justice, and is permeated by the spirit of selfishness and not of love.
As was mentioned earlier, I am the vice president currently of the organization known as Worker Justice Wisconsin. It's a combination of unions and religious congregations and secular groups and individuals. We put on every Labor Day weekend this Labor in the Pulpits, where we try to get invited to various congregations to talk about workers, unions, and that kind of thing. One of our primary purposes is to assist non-union low-wage workers to enforce their legal rights on the job, such as getting paid what they're owed. Two-thirds of our clients are immigrants, 80% are people of color, 70% make under $10 an hour, and for 60%, Spanish is their main or only language. I have a few flyers that I'll put in the back of the room about Worker Justice Wisconsin. I don't have enough for everybody, but those that are particularly interested should take one. I'll also leave a few membership forms in case you would like to join the organization. But I'm here not to talk about Worker Justice Wisconsin, but about labor unions and their history. As mentioned earlier, one of the projects I engaged in my retirement was to work with a videographer by the name of Jim Brown, and we put together a labor history, a history of unions in the United States from the very beginning. And it's in six parts, each around 15 minutes, so they can be shown at each part can be shown at a meeting or in a classroom. And total of the six parts, around 15 minutes, comes to 90 minutes. Well, I'm going to try and give that to you today in 15 minutes. And I can do this because, frankly, for about the first 150 years of our nation's history, unions were not very successful. There were many efforts but only some of the, in some cases, skilled trades who were working in a localized economy did have some success. But manufacturing unions and other unskilled workers often tried to organize unions, but they almost always were unsuccessful. They usually wound up having to go on strike to try and lessen their exploitation, but those strikes were usually broken, and the unions were broken as well, often with the assist of the militia. That's because the courts, the government, and employers during the first 150 years of our history were very anti-worker and anti-union. We did, in fact, in this country have an economic caste system. You must remember that this country, for the majority of the 19th century, legally recognized slavery, and for wage slaves, those who worked for a living at unskilled or even semi-skilled workers, were also considered nothing but commodities. They worked for low wages, long hours, dangerous conditions, usually the worst jobs, the dirtiest jobs, the toughest jobs, going to the most recent immigrants. This was pretty much the case until the Great Depression. The Great Depression in the 1930s, and at the beginning of the Great Depression in the 30s, workers again rose up and attempted to form unions, and in most cases, once again, they were crushed. This all changed in the mid-30s. In 1935, the federal government passed the National Labor Relations Act, which basically recognized unions and provided processes for by which there could be oversight by the government of organizing efforts and enforcement of those organizing efforts. This changed the equation, obviously. No longer was the government on the side of employers only. They attempted to be neutral. This led to massive organizings for the next decade, throughout the rest of the 30s and most of the 1940s, in massive organizing in the industrial sector. Auto workers, steel workers, garment workers, electrical workers, millions of workers were organized into unions during this time. And this continued throughout World War II, where the War Labor Board assisted the process of union recognition because they didn't want strikes. They wanted to maintain production amongst the production for the war. At about the same time of the passage of National Labor Relations Act in the mid-30s, the umbrella organization for unions, the only one that had been successful and lasting to this date, was the American Federation of Labor, the AFL. And it stressed the organization of skilled workers only and ignored unskilled and semi-skilled workers. But there were some unions within the AFL that thought workers, all workers, should be organized and organized from wall to wall at any particular place of employment. Those workers, or those unions, split off from the AFL and created the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations. And the two umbrella organizations then for the next 20 years were rivals and were in competition, and this, I think, added to the organizing that was going on. All of this was kind of the high point of union organizing in the United States in that 10-year period after 1935. But after World War II ended in 1945, business and conservative politicians sought to return to the days prior to the passage of the National Labor Relations Act. And they passed a law called the Taft-Hartley Act, which outlawed many of the protections that had formerly been guaranteed to labor unions and workers under the National Labor Relations Act. Most notable amongst these protections that were taken away was the requirement that if you're covered by a union contract, you need to pay dues in order to cover the cost of enforcing that contract. The Taft-Hartley law provided something that's called right to work, which individual states, state by state, could pass a law saying it's illegal in our state for an employer and a union to agree to automatic dues checkoff and dues payment by all of the workers covered by a particular contract. This obviously weakened unions, and this occurred at this time in the late 40s and throughout the 50s. Most often it was southern states where unions never really got a big toehold at all, in large part because of this law. So after fighting each other and being in competition for 20 years, the AFL and the CIO merged in 1955. And at the time they merged, unionization in the United States was at its peak. About 35% of workers who were not agricultural workers or management were in labor unions in the mid-50s. This percentage of the workforce in unions would decline from that point on. Partly it declined because, frankly, labor union leaders were kind of complacent and they relaxed because they were no longer fighting each other. They didn't have the same kind of competition they once had from the other federation. But also because of the Taft-Hartley law and for a number of other factors. And while this percentage of workers covered by unions declined slowly at first, the absolute number of workers covered by a union peaked in the mid-1970s with over 20 million workers in the United States members of labor unions. Now, the decline that was taking place, and as I said, it was not drastic, was somewhat camouflaged in absolute numbers because during the 1960s and 70s, public sector unions organized a lot. And by the mid-70s, there were 4 million public sector workers who were members of labor unions in the United States. And this was because many states passed laws that sort of modeled after the National Labor Relations Act in order to allow public sector workers and state employees, county employees, city employees, school employees to organize into unions. Then during the 1970s, we also saw a rise in the amount of anti-union activism by employers, union busting and substantial union avoidance activities in the 1970s. As was mentioned, and you can hold it up, Lila, in Madison, the most notable effort at union busting was from Madison Newspapers Incorporated, M&I, where they did break their unions. But there were a lot of organizing efforts in the 70s in Madison that were also aborted because the labor law had been changed and the court's interpretation of the law was more and more conservative and more pro-employer. Nationally, probably the most the prime example of how difficult it had become for unions to organize new workers is exemplified by the J.P. Stevens textile company in Roanoke Rapids. It's an organizing effort that took 11 years and several defeats before it was finally successful in getting the workers organized there, winning a union election, and then another 6 years in a national boycott before they even got a first contract. While it's never mentioned by name, it's in the movie, it's what the movie Norma Rae was loosely based on. The question is, why did this more rabid anti-union activity occur in the 70s instead of earlier? And there's a lot of reasons. As I mentioned earlier, the unions were had gotten complacent, union leadership, and they're kind of caught off guard. But also, the manufacturing in the world was devastated everywhere except in the United States during World War II. factories were bombed, and rail transportation, and all the things that go into a successful manufacturing were ruined by the World War II. Now, those countries, it took them about, you know, a couple decades to recover from that. And when they did, they had built more modern and more efficient manufacturing operations than the United States, which had basically had a monopoly for a couple decades, and ownership was very complacent because they kept making money, and they wanted to keep making money, so they would agree to improvements for the workers during contract negotiations. That was one of the many reasons. And then, of course, there was, you know, this trade competition. Where more efficient countries were able to gobble up a lot of, say, the automobile market, for example. And of course, they had there was automation going on, which meant fewer workers in unionized plants. And of course, as I mentioned earlier, the Taft-Hartley Act and judicial interpretations. And then there was the oil crisis in the early mid-70s, which put a squeeze on employment and manufacturing in the United States, many other factors as well. And all of this kind of culminated in the late 70s and in 1980, when the Chrysler Corporation was on the verge of bankruptcy. And the government had to bail out the Chrysler Corporation. And as part of that bailout, the union, the United Auto Workers, had to agree to wage concessions and some benefit concessions. And this really signaled the fact that things don't always have to improve for workers. And it was kind of trumped by Ronald Reagan when he became president, and the air traffic controllers went on strike, and he fired the strikers. And so during the 1980s and 1990s, it was really a period of rampant concession bargaining and union busting, and an accelerated decline of labor union membership in the United States. And then by the 2000s, the attacks were turned on public sector workers after the concession and union busting on private sector workers in the 80s and 90s. Of course, the most notable example of the attack on public sector workers was here in Wisconsin with Scott Walker and Act 10, which essentially eliminated collective bargaining for public sector employees and therefore substantially weakened their unions. Walker also agreed to a right-to-work law, which had for the most part been concentrated in the southern states and not the northern states. And this occurred in other union strongholds like Michigan and Indiana and Ohio. They followed suit from Walker. As a result, today there's only a little over 10% of workers in the United States that are covered by a union contract. Now, while historically unions have not been without their warts, I would nevertheless argue that it is a bad thing that unions represent less than one-third of the workforce today that they represented 65 years ago. You ask why? One of the income gap, which I assume most of you are aware of, is now at a point where it's equivalent to what it was in the 1920s. Before the Great Depression and before the National Labor Relations Act. In our labor history video, one of the last images that we have in the last part is a chart that shows 1968 to 2011 decline of labor union membership. And then laid on top of that shows the decline in share of income by the middle class. And if this was happening to the middle class during this period of union decline, you can imagine the effect on the lower class, the working class in inner cities, rural areas, Indian reservations, throughout the country, they suffered even more. And we now have these tremendous pockets of poverty and hopelessness in the richest country in the world. Now, the first of the seven principles that Unitarianism affirms and promotes is the inherent worth and dignity of every person. I would argue that one step toward promoting the inherent worth and dignity of every person would be to restore government protection of the right to organize unions so that every job becomes a job which people can make a living wage at, a decent living. I want to thank you for inviting us once again this year, Worker Justice Wisconsin. And remember, I will put some membership forms and our flyer in the back that you can grab when you leave. Thank you much.